Doug, you're going with option three. You're descending into the turbulence and continuing away from a landing site. And if you still have a headache when you get down to 3,000 feet, you'll turn around and land. That's opposed to saying, hey, I'm going to descend now with the intent of landing, but if my headache goes away, I'll turn around and keep going north. Let me throw an extra piece of information in. Your headache probably isn't going to go away, even if it's hypoxia, just descending to 3,000 feet because you haven't given it enough time. It's going to take a while for that to go away. So can I sell you on changing plans? Changing plans to shoot the approach, and then if your headache goes away, keep going? Or are you sticking with your plan to just descend?
Nope, you can't sell me on it at all. I'll state right out from the very get-go, your assumption is that I'm still going to have a headache. My assumption is, from my experience, that I might very well not. The question is, what is causing the headache? Is it hypoxia? Is it dehydration? Is it carbon monoxide poisoning? It could be a variety of things, okay? So my answer pretty much in some ways, as in so many answers in aviation, is it depends, okay? This AME who I consulted is a member of CAMI, which is the Civil Aviation Medical Institute. It's basically the FAA division of the medics, of the AMEs, okay? And this was his recommendation, and I highly respect this gentleman. So my response is, I'm going to descend to 3,000 feet and see. Now, there's some people have a headache all their lives. There are other people, it might very well go away. Your assumption is that it isn't. My assumption is that it is. Neither of us might be right, but I'm going to wait and see till I get down there. I'm down there, I still have it, then I'm turning around and going back. I'm down there and it's gone, I'm continuing.
Fair point. Let me go to some of the other choice three people with the same kind of query. It may take a while for this to go away. Catherine, you're nodding. Why is that a reasonable choice? Is there something to add to what Doug said?
Yeah, the only thing I'd change is I'd make my answer a 2.67. I think I would descend.
This is the PhD in mathematics. Letting it down right here.
I'm interpolating to down to 5,000 feet instead of 3,000. Anybody who knows me knows I hate to fly low. I want options in case I have an anomaly with my airplane. So I'd go down to 5,000 feet. Reasoning that, you know, my hope is that, as Doug, even if it doesn't go right away, if it's because of the altitude, it will be improving. And also, as I go to the Northwest, the weather is improving. So I'm doing myself a favor by going toward better weather and having an easier approach in landing.
Frank, do you have anything to add to that as another member of the descend to 3,000 camp?
Nothing to add to that, but I'm going to add one thing that we haven't really discussed yet. At 11,000 feet, the pilot is concerned, is it hypoxia or is it carbon monoxide poisoning? As soon as I realize that, come to that realization, I'm going to dramatically increase the fresh air ventilation in that aircraft. Mm-hmm. If it is CO, that will help the headache abate as I'm descending. So that gives me more data when I'm down at 3,000. Okay, the headache's going away. Good, I can continue. Headache's not going away. I need to land, even if it means turning around and landing.
Right, and the fresh air will definitely just help kind of wake everything up and get your focus level to rise a little bit, you know, at the same time, eliminate one of the variables, because that's part of the problem, right? It also could be the pilot has a headache just because of the turbulence. I mean, you know, that's the big unknown here. Let me go over to the John Zimmerman and Dave side of the table here, literally a side of the table as we happen to be sitting. You two are staying up high. I want to know why that's the right thing. John, you're nodding, so that means you go first.
We got to make sure the cure is not worse than the disease here. And that's sort of my bias. If you found the only smooth air over southern Georgia and Florida, it looks like for now. I'm going to do nothing for a little. Well, I shouldn't say do nothing. I'm going to relax for a minute, kind of get a hold of things. I've had a pretty sporty ride up through the clouds. I'm not real anxious to go right back down into IMC, into turbulence, shoot an approach in actual IMC. I'm not sure that's going to help my headache a whole lot. Obviously, hypoxia is a consideration, but I don't think the evidence is compelling right now. You know, we just got up here. It's not like we've been cruising along at 14,000 feet for 3 hours. I'm in, you know, reasonably good shape. And yeah, you know, hypoxia can happen lower. I'm not, you know, going to be too blasé, but I take some deep breaths. That can make a huge difference. I've worn a pulse oximeter. And if you do about 30 seconds of deep breathing, you can get 4 or 5 points on the pulse oximeter. If I'm worried about CO, I'm going to turn the heat off, open the fresh air vents. You know, there are things I can do here at 11,000 feet to buy myself a little more time. And I'm just going to basically take it 5 minutes at a time. I might even set a timer in ForeFlight for 5 minutes and just kind of check every 5 minutes, how am I doing? Because as long as I'm on top, I'm VMC, and I'm smooth, I'm going to be very reluctant to give that up.
Let me stay with you for a second, John. What would you say to people who said, that sounds great, but if it is hypoxia or it's carbon monoxide poisoning, every minute counts here. And the longer you delay on acting, the more impaired you become, simultaneously with becoming less able to deal with your impairment, whether it's either of those things.
Yeah, certainly true. They're slightly different threats. The CO poisoning, you have a little more control over. I mean, unless we have just a really bad full exhaust leak, firewall leak, most likely cause of CO is going to be the heater. So if we can just be cold for a little bit, close that off, crack some fresh air, really get some fresh air moving, that's going to help that threat a lot. Maybe not solve it, but it should help it. The hypoxia, I guess I'd just be surprised if after 45 minutes, a mid-40s person in good shape is going to be dramatically degraded at 11,000 feet. I guess I'm suspicious of that. I'm also suspicious that going down is going to instantly fix it. I mean, I've done some flights like this that you are a little groggy after 3 hours at altitude, and it's not like 10 minutes down low makes it go away. I mean, and that's why I'm worried about shooting the approach in actual. The fact that my destination is VFR is a key piece for me, because if I can fly, as we heard over here, that, you know, I'm going towards better weather, and I agree that that's kind of a nice part of it. So, you know, there's no good options here. This is a great scenario because there are no good options. And our job here is to pick the least bad. And so for me, the least bad right now is hang on for a few minutes.
Right. And every descent below this altitude, you know, shoot an approach or continue, you're back in the turbulence, which is fatiguing and, you know, distracting and all of those things. Dave, are there any additional reasons that you want to stay at 11,000?
No, I think John stated it really well. One option a Navion pilot has is exchanging hypoxia for hypothermia, because you can you can slide that canopy open a little bit and you get all the fresh air you could possibly want. So you could, but the combination of turning off the heat, turning up the vent, letting that ibuprofen work, drinking some water, having some deep breaths, relaxing, and letting the trend toward better weather continue is, to me, the best strategy here.
Before we delve more deeply into any of these specific pieces, John Krug, I haven't had a chance to hear from you. You're the only split decision one here. 3/4, what does that mean? Play that out.
Well, it's basically the same as Doug was thinking. Descend now down to 3,000 and assess it. If things get better, which I doubt they will because it's not enough time to do this, either turn around or continue slightly ahead. There's two other airports ahead which are both reporting reasonable weather. It's Valdosta and there was another one, which are only about 20, 25 miles ahead. And it's going to take you half that just to descend from 11,000 down to 3 and put you in a better position, because if it is CO, CO is very insidious. It's the silent killer, if you will, you know, and it can creep up on you and you're sitting at 11,000 feet, fat, dumb, and happy, and, you know, start making
getting dumber by the minute,
getting
right?
Dumber, yeah, by the minute.
Not very happy, though.
No, no, but you're not fat. Although right. After last night's dinner. I just think it, you know, it takes away one unknown. It takes away the hypoxia. And potentially gives you a little bit more oxygen for the CO. But I think the key is you got to take some action here. And it's not one of those cases where, you know, any action is preferable. You got to take a focused action. The focused action is get into thicker air.
Frank.
In the scenario setup, we had a very strong clue that I think we've been overlooking a little bit. The headache started early. It didn't start at 11,000 feet. It started early. Okay, it was bumpy. My money is on a CO problem. And hopefully this pilot, because of the way the scenario was worded, hopefully this pilot is thinking along the same lines. Okay, it could be the turbulence. It could be hypoxia. But it started early, so the biggest concern really should be CO. Let's take care of that and eliminate that as a possibility.
Dave?
I've got a question for my Descend Now friends, and that is this an emergency? Are you declaring an emergency and vacating that altitude and going to land at the earliest possibility, or is this just a preference?
Well,
I would say it's important to get down quickly, but I wouldn't yet declare an emergency. Now, if center says you got traffic underneath you and it's going to be 20 minutes before you can get down, it's okay. I need a vector to the side so I can descend more quickly.
Catherine?
Yeah, I'm the same way. I think descend and then assess. I wouldn't call it an emergency. I need to gather more information.
Yeah, John? Precautionary, I think, is the word there rather than emergency. You know, but it goes back to what I said earlier where you got to take some action.
Frank, you brought up a great point that the headache started during the climb, even if it was during turbulence. And, you know, what's the distractor here and what's the root cause? We've created a scenario that really obfuscates that. That's the problem. If you're going to assume that it's the worst case thing, which is arguably the CO poisoning, why would you continue on three rather than make it four and land? It seems to me if it's that dire and you need to deal with the CO, and that's what it likely is, why not just land now?
I'm saying it's likely that, but I'm not confident enough that it is that to make an emergency decision based on it being that. And when you get down to 3,000, and like I said, first thing I'm going to do is provide ventilation. Hopefully that's going to mitigate. If it is CO, hopefully it's going to mitigate that pretty much right away and over time improve the my reaction to it, hopefully improve the headache. And if with ventilation and the descent, I've still got a headache, okay, then I'm sure I'll turn around. Or, I'll reevaluate. When I'm at 3,000 feet, what's the closest airport?
Of course, you will be doing this in turbulence in IMC. That is the disadvantage of being down there, but you will be in thicker air. John?
Yeah, to me, if I'm not doing one, let's say I take my advice and I set my timer and after 10 minutes, I'm more concerned, I'm going to land right away at Lake County. I'm either going to stay where I am in good weather, smooth air, or I'm going to go land because, among other things, while your destination has good weather, in between there is this little line of rain. And up at 11,000, I'm on top. I can visually see where are the higher parts of this, maybe where there are some potential cells. I really like that. I really like when there's any possibility for convection to be on top doing that visually. And I really worry that if I'm down at 5 or 3,000 feet in the soup, I'm going to potentially have to deal with that little line of rain there. So to me, if I'm not continuing up top, I'm going to land and handle it on the ground.
So it's one or it's four,
yeah.
But there ain't nothing in
ain't
between.
Ain't nothing in between.
Right. Dave?
Yeah, I was just going to take a little issue with John Krug here because I don't think that this situation demands action now. And I think as pilots, we have a built-in bias toward action. And how many times have you requested a different altitude, vectors, change of heading, all sorts of situations that by the time that quickly resolve themselves? And I think what this situation really calls for is a little stoicism. Just, you know, take the steps that you can and towards turning off the heater, improving the ventilation, hydrating, and just deal with it for a while. And, you know, when you talk about worst case scenarios, you got no imagination when it comes to worst case scenarios. What if this is an aneurysm? You're dead anyway. You know, so just be a little stoic here. Reject the bias toward action that pilots have by inclination and just deal with the situation you've got, let the weather improve, and then if you need to take more steps later, you still can.
Well, let's run with that a little bit because we do have ambiguity about what the problem here is, and it's something about the pilot. It could be as benign as just a headache. A headache is a headache. You know, you got rattled around. it could be something potentially deadly, but that we could rectify, like hypoxia or even carbon monoxide. Or like you said, the pilot is ill of undetermined cause. And I remember talking with Brent Blue about this, how pilots, again, speaking to what you just said, we tend to want to continue even through personal suffering and adversity. You know, maybe it's suffering through getting all of our ratings. But if you are ill as a pilot, there is a chance that you will get progressively more ill from any cause. And there are lots of things that could be fixed and dealt with early on. I mean, if it was a cardiac event that was starting as a headache and you got on the ground sooner, you may be able to get the services you need sooner. Whereas if you stay in the air longer, it's going to progress. And even by the time you get on the ground, it's too late. John.
That's assuming you get on the ground safely. I mean, this is one of my concerns is that there's a temptation to think, oh, well, we'll just go land and that's a rock solid option. If I'm having some type of medical event, shooting an approach in actual IMC in turbulence, I may ball up the airplane trying to save myself. And I think that's a non-zero chance here. And so that's on my mind that it's not like the weather's flawless and sure, let's just go land and take the conservative route. I'm not convinced that's as conservative as it sounds. You've got a tough 20 minutes of descending through the crag, shooting an approach. That's not guaranteed for me if you're not in a great mental state.
John.
Yeah, well, I'd counter Dave. and I think it is, you know, first of all, as pilots, we have no business being stoics. Suppose your wife and or spouse and family is in the back, you know, would you handle it any different? Because they're relying on you now to get them safely back on the ground. I think given this scenario set up with this pilot who's in reasonably good physical condition, has a good cardio system, knows his or her body really well, and something like this is happening, it's starting to raise red flags. And the longer you go at 11,000, whether it's hypoxia or CO, it's not going to get better. You know, if the ibuprofen doesn't handle it, it's not going to get better. So by descending, you remove at least hypoxia from it. You can open up the vents. It doesn't call for a, you know, crash emergency spin out of the clouds and land the first place you get to. It may be diverting and going back or Suwannee or Valdosta. But I definitely think it means to get down.
Let's change the scenario just a little bit to kind of tease out what is driving people's decisions here. Suppose it was turbulent, but it was VFR. So you're at 11,000 feet or 11,500. You get this headache. You don't know, headache, hypoxia, or carbon monoxide poisoning, or it was just the turbulence and you're in smooth air on top. If you knew you didn't have to shoot an approach, you just had to find an airport and land when it's time to land, would that change it for anyone? Would the people up top descend?
Maybe a little. I mean, part of it too, you got to give, there's this trade-off between if you wait too long, you're incapacitated. But also if you act too quickly, if I shut off the heat and take some ibuprofen, I kind of want to give that a few minutes to see if that does anything, because if maybe the Advil kicks in and maybe the heat being off fixes my problem, if I don't give that a little bit of time, then I really haven't done much to diagnose the problem. So that would probably change my calculus a little, but I'm still biased towards hanging out for at least a few minutes.
Yeah, I went to a lot of trouble and effort and burned a lot of gas at getting this Navy on all the way up to 11,000. You know, so I'm gonna enjoy it for a little while before I head down. And it's true that it's like in VMC, mm-hmm. it's orders of magnitude simpler to do a descent and land.
Right. So you could just, there's no approach needed. You can, you know, go directly to the airport. Not quite what John was talking about spinning out of the sky, but you could really expedite changing plans.
Sure. You could cancel IFR, descend, and that would just be a lot simpler proposition.
So part of what it sounds like is there is kind of a continuation bias in every direction around the table against the thing you really don't want to do, right? Don't want to descend out of this nice position in the smooth air above. So there are lots of good reasons to just stay there. Or don't want to turn around and land right now. So there are good reasons to go down and continue. I think that could be placed on just about every one of these decisions, you know, other than perhaps land right now. But John's point is really well taken, that shooting an approach while feeling ill, in turbulence, in IMC that you didn't really plan for and probably briefing on the way down, those are a number of strikes against you to do what is objectively, in big air quotes here, the safest thing. Frank.
There's an aspect we've touched on but haven't really discussed at all, and that is hydrating. Personal experience. My wife and I used to fly a Mooney. It was a turbo normalized Mooney, so we would frequently get up into the teens with, you know, cannulas. And she was susceptible to, you know, headaches. And she found that it was worse if she didn't hydrate enough, which is apparently somewhat common. We didn't realize it at the time. But hydration goes hand in hand with the headache from altitude. And the reason she wasn't hydrating is because we wanted to make that four-hour leg.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's rubber meets the road here. Like, yeah. There is a downside to hydrating, right? Yeah. Go ahead.
But anyway, so we were discussing that, and you know, bless her heart, when we were looking at the twins, she said, "Why don't we get something pressurized?" I said, "Oh, okay, dear." But the point being is that I think we've mentioned it a couple times, but this pilot should also, along with improving the ventilation and descending, should also drink some water.
You know, in researching for this scenario, I want to support what you just said, Frank. Actually, there's a biological reason for it. The more fluid you have in your body actually is able to move that around, to shuffle the fluid around inside the body and help compensate for the loss of oxygen due to altitude. And the more dehydrated you are, literally the worse your body's ability to compensate for the hypoxia, let alone just the how you feel cruddy being dehydrated. So that's legit and absolutely will help both just being dehydrated or being hypoxic. John.
So for a pilot who intends to cruise at 11,000 feet, which is approaching oxygen altitudes, this pilot was pretty unprepared with this airplane. And there's a couple of things that you'd easily do. You know, one, apparently there's no CO detector. The pulse oximeter is another one. And carrying a portable O2 bottle. You know, the old fighter pilot trick to take a couple of hits of oxygen and, you know, just see if nothing else, if it is either one of those things, that's definitely going to help too. I know for me, who's considerably older than this middle-aged pilot here, 11,000 feet cruising for a while with me, I'm getting a headache regardless. You know, it's just, I used to be able to do that, and I can't do it as well as I did before. So I do the same thing with a little O2 bottle and take a hit every once in a while.
Yeah, and interestingly, again, doing research on this and personal experience, it doesn't really matter how in shape you are. All you can do by being in good shape or not is shift your sort of personal pressure altitude where it becomes a problem a little bit. Part of it is just physiological. Part of it is acclimatization to altitude, and pilots just generally who we have a little bit more red blood cell capacity just because we periodically decompress and recompress as we go along. John.
Yeah, I would have just underlined that if you're going to do cross-country travel in any type of high-performance airplane, meaning Cessna 182 or up, you absolutely should have a CO detector and a pulse oximeter. Those are non-negotiable for me. And the CO detector is easy these days. They're in all kinds of equipment. The pulse oximeter, I always recommend for people, even who don't fly high, just go take it on your next flight and try it. You may be shocked at 6,000 feet that it's low, and you can learn kind of where your personal threshold is, and you can do some of the things I said about breathing deeper and does that make an impact. So I think the pulse oximeter is a great idea. Oxygen as well. I hate flying with an oxygen bottle if I'm not going to be going really high. You got the hoses, the cannulas. I'll sometimes buy those boost oxygen bottles. You can buy them at the gas station, you know, and they're not FAA approved. But in this case, where you don't legally need oxygen per the FARs, a couple hits of that, it can be like turning up the lights at night. And I think they're lightweight, they're easy to throw in your bag and can buy you some time.
How many of you routinely fly with oxygen? Just a show of hands around the table here. We got one hand up, a sort of kinda, and Catherine's smiling over there. So I'm going to call on Catherine.
Yeah, as I mentioned earlier, I generally like to fly high. You know, when I come here, I will often try to fly at 11,000 feet. And, you know, I have felt fine for all of those years. And recently, I got as a present an oxygen concentrator. And I tried it on this trip here from Tennessee to New Hampshire a couple of days ago. And honestly, I was stunned at the difference. You know, I usually feel fine, maybe a little tired. I felt great the entire time. So my perception that, oh, I'm just fine at that altitude is really pretty faulty. I also learned that apparently you have to have a prescription for those. So
we're not going to ask how you got one without a prescription, yeah, but okay.
Apparently that gift came with a... Anyway.
It was a gift from your doctor. Yeah, that's it. That's
right.
It. Doug.
Yeah, I'd just like to say, and really following up pretty much with what John Z said about knowing yourself, every one of us has our own unique ways of responding to altitude, to carbon monoxide, to dehydration. And it requires self-awareness and discipline. I mean, I've always lived my life, ignore it, it'll get better, it'll go away. Ever much of my life, it kind of has. Sometimes it's taken a hell of a lot longer than I expect or had hoped. But we're all different and unique, and it's important for us to recognize our own uniqueness. The opportunity to use one of these proats, if you get to see one at AirVenture or at Oshkosh, they've been at Winneman Aviation, find out how you actually respond so you can recognize it. I don't like to drink a lot of water, you know. And I find myself sometimes getting irritated. This was back when I was a low-time instructor. I'm flying six clients in the pattern all day long, six patterns. The first three are making the same mistakes, and I'm, oh, cool, boop-de-do, that's cool, you know. Fourth one, I'm starting to get a little, by the time I got to the sixth one, I was so irritated and had a headache, all because I wasn't drinking. And I finally realized that, and now I have to discipline myself to drink. When I'm flying, I have to discipline myself. I'm not going to guzzle down a quart of water the first half hour into the flight because it won't be external pressures then, but internal pressures that ruin my flight. But we have to recognize our own needs and our ways of reducing things.
Now, I thought all young flight instructors did lots of drinking because that was my experience and all of my friends. So this is novel to me that
well,
you didn't
I was never a young flight instructor.
there's the secret. There's the secret. Catherine.
Yeah, I'd be curious to find out folks' response to CO. You know, as you say, Doug, probably responses vary to altitude effects. But for CO, has just a show of hands, how many people have had carbon monoxide detected in their airplanes? So for me, in flight, it was just once, and it was in a Cherokee that I used to have, and I used to have one of those little cards that you stick up on the dash. I'm flying along, and John, you'll appreciate this. So
they're terrible. John, for those of you who can't see right now, is going, no, okay. With the cards. Just nix the cards.
But see, I didn't know that at the time. And so I feel I'm just fine. I look over, and that little orange circle is black. And my understanding is you can hold that thing up to the exhaust of your car for half an hour, and it still won't turn black. And no kidding, I didn't know, I hadn't noticed anything. So obviously I turned around, landed, and had my mechanic come out, put a vacuum cleaner blowing into the exhaust, and the thing just leaked like a sieve. But it was stunning to me, and so I have real proof that you can't necessarily even tell. I didn't have a headache. I didn't feel any effects of that CO poisoning.
Yeah, because you caught it early, although I definitely recommend a digital detector instead.
Right.
John.
Yeah, I had similar experience. I had it in a helicopter, and what was interesting to me is how you can pretend it's not there. You know, the alarm was going off. It was, I don't know, 300 parts per million. It skyrocketed. Well, surely that's wrong. That damn thing's beeping again. You know, it's always doing that. And it took about three times of resetting it before the gray matter kicked in and said, you know, maybe this time it's right. And I shut off the heat, but I had no indication otherwise. And same thing, they found a quarter-size hole in the exhaust right there. But it's even with the indicator, you have to convince yourself that it's trustworthy sometimes.
Well, it's 20% of our oxygen is used by our brain at any given time. So depleting the oxygen supply, unfortunately, cripples our ability to deal with depleted oxygen supply. And that's one, no matter what the reason, why it's one of the cruelest things. Dave.
Yeah, let's just also recognize that the aviation regs on when oxygen is required are antiquated, not based on science.
Not at all.
And also, when you look at the military, where it's a bunch of 20-something kids who are really fit flying aircraft, they're required to use oxygen at far lower altitudes.
Yeah, my understanding is that a lot of those oxygen regulations actually come from the MEAs on airways, and they wanted to make it so that you could possibly cross the mountains without oxygen. So that's where it came from. So again, pulling from research, because this was really interesting here, 50% of people, if you go above 8,000 feet of pressure altitude, will experience hypoxia just out of the population. So think about that with passengers that you have on board. And you, Doug, mentioned, you know, the sixth flight of the day, repeated decompressions and recompressions are more of a factor in you getting hypoxia than duration of exposure. So multi-leg flights, the last legs of the day, you are actually more susceptible on those legs. And one thing that's been said around this table a lot about oxygen, people have talked about just like using a boost or taking a little bit of oxygen before an approach, right, to sort of charge your brain. It was Ken Stahl from AOPA was talking about pre-oxygenation in surgery, where they get people and they give them extra oxygen early on to help boost the oxygenation in the bloodstream, and that a pilot can do this if you're going to be up at altitude to start using oxygen on the way up to sort of saturate not just your body but your tissues with oxygen, and your susceptibility, if you start talking and you start, instead of breathing through your nose and the cannula, because you're talking to your friend, you know, you'll deplete again, that pre-oxygenation can really help you out. Catherine.
Yeah, so on my experiment flying here a couple days ago, I had a pulse oximeter, and I was up high, and I, you know, normally my oxygen levels are, you know, 98, 99 on the ground. And it was down at 92 or 93. And what I did is I had the pulse oximeter on my finger, and then I put the oxygen on, and it took seconds for it to go up to 98 or 99. So the nice thing about getting down to a lower altitude, it may take a little while, if that's the culprit, it may take a little while for the headache to go away, but it's clear to me how quickly you're going to be at least getting a better oxygen supply sooner.
Yeah, and one thing we didn't say, and I really think is important to say here too, is that the pulse oximeter alone will not rule out carbon monoxide, because your blood will absorb the carbon monoxide. In fact, it displaces the oxygen on your hemoglobin, but it looks bright red. And that's what the pulse oximeters are looking at. They're looking at the color of the blood. You know, the takeaways from this short and sweet. If you are feeling ill in the air, you need to consider doing something about it, either whether it's starting a timer to how long until you're going to decide, or getting yourself down, getting yourself on the ground. And even more simple, if you don't have a pulse oximeter and you don't have a CO2 detector, at the end of this recording, go out and get one now. It's just standard fare, and possibly even some kind of portable O2 for those moments when your brain needs a boost.